Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to Iris today. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, September 18th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Now let's turn to the sports section of the Courier. Now, high school cross country, Cedar Falls flexes depth. West's Olivera takes second in girls' competition. The story filed by Ethan Petrick, Dateline Cedar Falls. The top-ranked Cedar Falls Tigers boys' cross-country team did not win the 38th Rich Engel Classic in typical fashion on Thursday. Already down, Connor Martin, who did not compete on Thursday, the Tigers lost number 2, Ahmed Aldemack, and number 3, Luke Hartman, midway through the race, as Aldemack stopped to help an injured Hartman. The Tigers took first place despite missing 3 of their top 5 runners. Quote, "I am really proud of the guys for stepping up," Cedar Falls head coach Brett Egan said. Quote, "We knew it was going to be a tough meet as we were training through it after our great performances at Marshalltown. For us to come away with a team victory was pretty surprising. I am really just happy with the guys and their efforts tonight," unquote. Cedar Falls narrowly edged out Cedar Rapids Kennedy 64-69 as 4 Tigers managed to finish inside the top 15. Sophomore Jaden Merrick, who broke the Cedar Falls school record exactly 1 week prior to Thursday, clocked his usual excellence with a time of 15 minutes 46.8 seconds, though 36 seconds slower than his school record mark. Merrick shattered the course record at Birdsall Park, beating the previous record of 15 minutes 51.7 seconds, set by Miles Wilson of Cedar Rapids Kennedy last year. As he leaves records in his wake, Merrick said his main motivator remains team success. Quote, "I am just hoping for the team to have good results," Merrick said, "and hopefully a good finish at state," unquote. Behind Merrick, Kieran DeGroote, John Ferguson, and Braden Frey finished 13th, 14th, and 15th, with times of 16 minutes 50.1, 16 minutes 52.1, and 16 minutes 57.0, respectively. Jack Considine rounded out the varsity scores for Cedar Falls in 21st with a time of 17 minutes 13.0. Quote, "They really believe in the training," Egan said. "They push each other in practice, and they just know they can compete at that level. Some of the guys, this was their first opportunity to be in that varsity race, so they know they could take advantage of it and compete with the top guys in the state," unquote. Ferguson also credited the team's success to their relationship and their training. Quote, "The relationship we have with each other, it is brotherhood," Ferguson said. "So we are pushing each other hard all day, every day at practices, keeping each other accountable and eating well," unquote. According to Merrick, the depth of the Tigers helped them to maximize their results from off-season and in-season training. Quote, "It is nice to have teammates there to push you," Merrick said. "In workouts and stuff, too, we have people to run with, so it helps a lot," unquote. The top-end talent, depth, and brotherhood allowed the Tigers to secure the top spot in Class 4A in the Iowa High School cross-country rankings beginning Week 3 of the season. According to Egan, the leadership of the Tigers' senior class of Considine, Frey, Hartman, Sam O'Hare, Tyler Bailey, and Vince Fredrickson stepped into leadership roles in the program. Quote, "It is just a really special group of seniors that are leading this team," Egan said. "I have known over the past 4 years that they were going to be a really awesome group to lead and that they were going to raise the bar for the program. It is a special mix of guys that I'm really thankful for," unquote. Senior Ahmed Aldemack, who transferred to Cedar Falls from Ames after last season, also provided a boost to the Tigers' lineup. Quote, the guys knew with him coming in that they needed to raise their game, Egan said. According to Ferguson, the Tigers knew, entering the season, that they possessed a unique blend of leadership, depth, and talent to make noise in Class 4A. Thus, they set their sights high at the start of the season and have not waffled on their goals since. Quote, it takes five to win a state championship, Ferguson said. That is what we are here to do, unquote. In an even greater show of depth, Cedar Falls also won the junior varsity competition on Thursday, with all seven of its JV competitors finishing in the top 15, including four top five finishes. Grundy Center duo posts top 10 finish. Grundy Center finished ninth in the team standings, but senior Caden Lynch and Emerson Volks posted standout performances in pacing the Spartans. Lynch led the way with a ninth-place finish, clocking a time of 16 minutes 44.0. Volks came in just behind Lynch with a time of 16 minutes 46.6, placing 10th overall. West's Olivier takes second. Nakia Olivier ran alone on Thursday night at the 38th Rich Engel Classic. The Waterloo West sophomore represented the Wahawks solo with a second-place finish overall, clocking a time of 18 minutes 51.9, a new personal best for Olivier, taking 11 seconds off her previous best. The time made her the Metro leader at the meet. Olivier is no stranger to placing well, taking 10th at state cross country as a freshman with a time of 19 minutes 27.45. However, running for Iowa Falls Alden AGWSR in Class 1A, the uniform and competition looked a little different. Since joining Waterloo West after her freshman season with the Cougars, Olivier has done nothing but pace the Wahawks. Her secret? The sophomore trains in the Waterloo West boys cross-country team. Quote, I practice with the boys, Olivier said, just to keep a faster pace and to be able to compete at a faster level. They have boys running 16 and 17, so I feel like if I can compete with them, I can compete with anyone at this level, unquote. According to Olivier, training with the boys' team helped her get stronger and run a better pace throughout the season. The jump from Class 1A to Class 4A offers its challenges, more travel, bigger schools, more competition. But they are challenges that Olivier embraces. Quote, I like the fact that I am able to compete against more competition, Olivier said, able to push myself and become a better athlete, unquote. Looking to return to state and medal at a higher place than in 2022, Olivier shaved nearly 2 minutes off her season opening time, a 20 minute 46.33 in Olwine 2 weeks ago on Thursday. Olivier credited her mindset to helping her achieve her career performance. Quote, I wanted to be under 19, Olivier said. I PR'd last week at 19.02, so this week's plan was to get underneath 19. I accomplished that, so now the goal is to PR every meet. Cedar Falls takes third. The hosting Tigers finished third as a team with a score of 111 points, finishing behind Dubuque Senior at 48 and Dubuque Hempstead at 50 in the team standings. Seniors Maddie Gallagher and Anna Becker paced Cedar Falls with times of 20 minutes 9.3 and 20 minutes 24.9. Gallagher took 13th overall, while Becker managed to come in at 18th overall. A trio of juniors rounded out the Tigers' varsity scorers. Josie Simonson, Zoe Zylstra, and Emily Meyer took 21st, 27th, and 37th with times of 20 minutes 33.0, 20 minutes 55.2, and 21 minutes 27.1, respectively. Here is the area high school roundup. Waterloo Christian outlasts Don Bosco in 5 sets. Reagan Wheeler had 21 kills and 5 blocks as Waterloo Christian outlasted Don Bosco in 5 sets Thursday in high school volleyball action. And here we have a photograph of Reagan Wheeler in uniform and holding a volleyball in one hand. The Regents won 24-26, 25-17, 25-11, 18-25, and 15-13. Trinity Renauld and Violet LaMarche added 14 and 9 kills, respectively. Kaylin Jones had 44 assists, while Alexis Harlan led the team with 31 digs. Waterloo Christian improved to 8-3 with the victory. Now, let's read local news from the Courier. Cedar Falls resident to compete on Wheel on Monday. Local therapist's appearance will air on KWWL at 6:30 p.m. Story filed by Andy Malone, and the dateline is Cedar Falls. A 45-year-old Cedar Falls therapist will be a contestant on Wheel of Fortune Monday night. Nicole Winther will be one of 3 contestants competing at 6:30 p.m. on KWWL-TV, the show's 41st season, and host Pat Sajak's final go-round. The owner of Consulting Connection and University of Northern Iowa social work professor has been a super fan since 2021, watching almost every show with her husband Cody, but has been a viewer off and on since its inception in 1975. It was always on in her Winther home after the evening news. Quote, "I told myself to just have fun," she said about her experience competing during a telephone interview Friday. Quote, "Being chosen and being here is a win. You're already winning. I was a little nervous. I just didn't want to end up as a bad gif or part of one of those videos featuring what not to do," unquote. Contestants on the show figure out hidden phrases by guessing letters one at a time. They win money or prizes as determined by a spin of the wheel for each correct consonant guessed. But they have to pay to see which vowels are in a puzzle. The contestant who has amassed the most winnings at the end of a game goes on to play the bonus round, during which even more can be won. Prizes frequently seen in the bonus round include automobiles, vacations, and more cash. An Iowan and Kansas native who spent time more specifically in Villisca, Winther has been a resident of Cedar Falls since 2001. She's a 2003 master's graduate of social work from UNI. When not working, she's spending time with her husband of 23 years and her 2 daughters, Ava, 6, and Ivy, 4. The episode was recorded in Los Angeles back in July, but the application and audition process began for her back in 2021. Winther remembers submitting a video of her authentic, goofy, and unscripted self, and then engaging in practice games over Zoom. She was ultimately selected despite some technical difficulties. Quote, "There was a commercial that came on and said, if you want to be a contestant, go online. And it described the process as being so easy. And Cody was like, hey, you should do that. And I responded, I don't think they'd pick me. Plus, my technological skills aren't so great. And I was concerned about any uploading, portals, downloads, or whatever," unquote. But Winther ended up going through with submitting an application anyway and found the process to be, indeed, easy peasy. After a year and a half, she didn't hear back and tried again. Quote, "I'm like, at this point, it is happening. I'm going to make this happen. If I have to submit something every week, it's going to happen." That was in January of 2023. I submitted a video and re-uploaded a picture, and it was in April that I got the email saying I had been chosen to advance to a virtual audition, unquote. A viewing party will be held from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Wild Hare American Bar and Grill at 2512 Whitetail Drive. Now, on a sad note, death leaves town stunned. Statewide outpouring of support follows Algona police officer's fatal shooting. This story comes to us by way of the Globe Gazette. Dateline Algona. An Algona police officer was shot to death while trying to arrest a man Wednesday, sparking an intense manhunt that ended with the suspect's capture near Sleepy Eye, Minnesota. Officer Kevin Cram was killed just before 8 p.m. Wednesday as he tried to serve an arrest warrant to 43-year-old Kyle Rickey, said Mitch Mortvedt, assistant director of the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. Cram, a 33-year-old husband and father who had been an officer in Algona since 2015, was pronounced dead at Kossuth Regional Health Center in Algona. The shooting took place in the 1100 block of South Minnesota Street in Algona. The officer's death left the normally quiet Kossuth County community of 5,300 people stunned. Quote, "Officer Cram was a kind and committed officer on our police force. He was a homegrown hero who served this community proudly and with integrity. Our hearts go out to his family, friends, fellow officers, dispatchers, and co-workers during this difficult time," said Algona Mayor Rick Murphy. Cram worked as an officer with the Nora Springs Police Department from 2013 until 2015, when he made the move to the Algona Police Department. He worked with Nora Springs Police Chief Jesse Dugan during that time. Quote, "With a two-person police department, Officer Cram and I worked very close together," Dugan said in a statement. Quote, "He was a great friend and co-worker. We spent time off duty hunting and fishing together. Officer Cram will be sadly missed by all," unquote. The shooting prompted a blue alert, letting the public know a suspect who posed a threat to law enforcement was on the loose. Algona residents were warned to lock their doors and shelter in place. Rickey was captured without incident just before midnight in Brown County, Minnesota, about 100 miles north of Algona. He was charged with first-degree murder, Mortvedt said, and will be held in Minnesota pending extradition. Quote, "Algona police officer Kevin Cram died serving his community," Iowa Department of Public Safety Commissioner Stephen Byens said during a press conference Thursday morning at the Kossuth County Election Center. Quote, "Algona police officer Kevin Cram answered the call to serve. Algona police officer Kevin Cram died because he chose to be a beacon of light. Algona police officer Kevin Cram died because he was willing to stand in the gap between good and evil. Algona police officer Kevin Cram died a hero," unquote. Quote, "Tragic, heartbreaking, gut-wrenching pain and agony, but we will bow our backs and we will be strong and we will continue to do our jobs," unquote. Rickey had appeared in Kossuth County Court earlier Wednesday on a charge of third-degree harassment. Cram was on patrol in Algona when he learned an arrest warrant had been issued for Rickey on the harassment charge, Mortvedt said. The officer went to a home where he thought Rickey might be, and upon finding him, told him he would be arrested. Cram was serving the warrant when Rickey took out a handgun and shot the officer. According to court records, Rickey was accused of contacting a victim multiple times over the course of 2 hours, and again several days later, after police told him to stop. On August 23rd, the victim showed an officer 63 unread messages and several missed phone calls from Rickey had sent to the victim. This happened after the victim had told Rickey she no longer wanted contact with him, court documents state. Rickey was arrested on August 28th, and a no-contact order was granted August 29th. The trial in that case is scheduled for November 3rd. During the press conference, Bayens said Cram died with honor. Quote, "The law enforcement community in Kossuth County is hurting, but they are not broken. They are shaken, but they are not broken," he said. quote, their hearts are heavy, but they will continue to honor Kevin's legacy by being that beacon of light in their communities, unquote. Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd released a statement expressing sadness for the loss of a law enforcement officer and honoring his and others' sacrifices. Quote, we are deeply saddened by the tragic loss of law enforcement hero Kevin Cram last night in Algona. Officer Cram wore the badge with honor to serve and protect. As we mourn his heartbreaking loss, we remember Officer Cram's selfless service and keep his family in our prayers. We will never take for granted the sacrifices made to keep us safe, and we will always stand strong alongside our law enforcement heroes, unquote. The state's congressional delegation also posted condolences on social media. Quote, please join me in saying an extra prayer for our men and women in blue today, unquote, Senator Joni Ernst said. Governor Kim Reynolds ordered flags to be flown at half-staff Friday in Cram's honor. Quote, Officer Kevin Cram died a hero, protecting his community and upholding the rule of law. Kevin and I are praying for his family, the Algona Police Department, and all the law enforcement officers in Kossuth County, Reynolds said in a statement. Quote, as flags are lowered across the state, Iowans honor Officer Cram's legacy and stand united with his brothers and sisters in uniform. We will never forget his service and sacrifice, unquote. Overdose arrest, story filed by Jeff Reinitz, in Dateline Waterloo. Waterloo police investigating an opioid overdose on September 8th have arrested one person. Officers arrested Colton James Heppner, 25, on charges of possession of fentanyl with intent to deliver after they found a plastic bag with powder and used hypodermic needles at his apartment at 1446 Olson Road. He was later released from jail pending trial. According to court records, authorities were sent to an overdose at the apartment at about 4:10 p.m. on September 8th. Police allege Heppner provided drugs to a person who then passed out. Heppner then administered Narcan nasal spray to reverse the effects. The person was examined by paramedics and survived, court records state. Naloxone, also known as Narcan, can save a life from an overdose of prescription narcotics, pain medication, or opioids in adults and in young children. This nasal spray is available at no charge at many pharmacies. Ask your pharmacist about naloxone. Man pleads in opioid death. This story filed by Jeff Reinitz, and the dateline is Independence. An Iowa City man has pleaded to federal charges in connection with a 2020 opioid overdose death in Buchanan County. Kevin Lorenzo Perry, 34, entered a plea to a single count of distribution of fentanyl resulting in death in U.S. District Court in Cedar Rapids on Wednesday. The offense is punishable by 20 years to life in prison, and the parties agreed to a sentence of 27 years behind bars as part of a plea negotiations, according to court records. Formal sentencing will be at a later date. Court records allege Perry sold $250 worth of what was supposed to be heroin to a person identified as JT in Buchanan County on February 6, 2020. The following morning, JT was found dead of fentanyl and acetylfentanyl intoxication, according to court records. Investigators found a bag containing 0.39 grams of a fentanyl acetylfentanyl mix on the deceased's computer desk. Perry is also serving a 22-year sentence for distributing fentanyl to two people in Iowa City who overdosed in May of 2020. One person from the Iowa City incident, identified as DK, died of an overdose of the drug, and the second, identified as RLC, survived an overdose, according to court records. Northeast Iowa Food Bank receives $2 million grant from the state. Story filed by Maria Cooper. Dateline Waterloo. The Northeast Iowa Food Bank received 40% of grant funds allocated through the American Rescue Plan to help the state deal with food insecurity. NEIFB's Executive Director Barb Prather announced it received a $2 million Iowa Food Insecurity Infrastructure Fund grant announced by Governor Kim Reynolds and the Iowa Economic Development Authority. And here we have a picture of a worker sorting food into boxes at the food bank. A news release states the $5 million fund was established to help Iowans get access to fresh and nutritious food. The grants were made available through state and local fiscal recovery funds, which is a program authorized by the American Rescue Plan Act. Prather said she appreciates that the grant is for infrastructure. Quote, "It's really hard a lot of times to raise money for brick and mortar," she said. "I think for nonprofits like ours, you have to have a strong infrastructure to access the food. If you don't have storage space for it, people aren't going to get fed." Prather said the food bank asked for $2 million, which was the maximum amount it could request. She believes that the state knows NEIFB would do its due diligence in spending it the right way, unquote. The funding will be used to remodel and renovate the food bank's facility, which is located at 1605 Lafayette Street. Prather said it will enable the food bank to add storage racking, expand the cooler and freezer section, update and certify the repacking area, and revamping the volunteer space. All of this would allow the facility to hold even more food and sanitary supplies. Prather said this is needed because she's seen an increased use in every program the food bank offers. She attributes this to the state's COVID-19 disaster proclamation ending in early 2022, as well as the expiration of the pandemic's SNAP temporary benefits. Less money for food, compiled with supply chain issues and inflation, make it harder for people to make ends meet, she said. In fiscal year 2022, Prather said the food bank dished out 6.6 million meals. In fiscal year 2023, that number increased more than 10% to 7.3 million meals. She said there were also drastic increases of people using the local pantry on site, after school meal program, mobile pantry, and summer feeding program. She said the items in high demand are any type of protein, fresh fruits and vegetables, and personal care items. Quote, "The long-term goal is to have storage to access more of that product," she said. NEIFB is still in the process of determining the facility's priorities, but they have a few things in the works that they are not ready to announce yet. Along with NEIFB, other facilities awarded include the Food Bank of Iowa in Ottumwa with $560,000, the River Bend Food Bank in Davenport with $607,000, and the Table-to-Table Distribution Network in Iowa City with $1.8 million. Council hearings set on library sidewalk program. Story filed by Maria Cooper. And the dateline is Waterloo. Residents will get the opportunity to speak at a few public hearings taking place during Monday's City Council meeting. The Council will meet at 5:30 p.m. at City Hall in the Council Chambers. This is Waterloo. There will be 5 public hearings. The first one is to review and approve a bid for interior renovations at the Waterloo Public Library. This came before the council in August when the only bid was rejected due to being over the engineer's estimate. The estimate is $270,000, and the only bid to be read on Monday is for $289,700. From Woodruff Construction in Waterloo. The council could also approve a sale and conveyance of property at 3921 Midway Drive, which was deemed abandoned by the Iowa Code 657A. The city sent out a request for proposal to rehabilitate or redevelop the property. The resolution is to approve a development agreement with the Dustin Aarons of Aarons Investments in the amount of $15,000. Aarons plans to demolish the existing home and build a new duplex with an estimated sale price of each unit at $300,000. Two public hearings will be held over the fiscal year 2024 Sidewalk Repair Assessment Program for Zone 3. The first will be to approve the proposed construction, fix the value of lots, and to adopt a schedule and estimate of costs. The council could also approve a bid for the Sidewalk Repair Assessment Program in the amount of $171,241 to Brock Even Construction, LLC of Jessup. There were three bids, all under the engineer's estimate of $299,952. The fifth hearing will be for a resolution awarding a bid for a prefabricated shelter at 3233 Ansborough Avenue. The only bid is from Cell Site Solutions of Cedar Rapids for $121,500. There was no engineer's estimate listed or any other details about the project. The council could also do the following things. Approve a resolution stating the city will not use eminent domain powers for the installation of fiber optics. And approve a resolution approving the completion of the fiscal year 2022 Hyperdrive RISE project in the amount of $1.3 million. The work was done by Peterson Contractors, Incorporated of Rhinebeck. And lastly, they will pass an ordinance establishing a sidewalk cafe program. Now in Cedar Falls, St. Pat's Parking up for final council vote. A final vote may be taken on Monday pertaining to St. Patrick's Catholic Church and future institutions' plans for new downtown parking lots. The City Council will hold its third and final reading of an ordinance allowing churches, schools, and other civic and institutional organizations to have parking, an accessory use, across the street from the principal use during its 7 p.m. meeting at City Hall at 220 Clay Street. Under the current code, parking must be on the same parcel. St. Patrick inquired earlier this year about a possible change to city code after purchasing a vacant half acre across the street at 123 West 7th Street for $960,000 from developer Brent Dahlstrom as part of campus expansion plans. The code is written to protect pedestrians in mixed-use areas through setbacks relative to the principal use. Additionally, a goal was to preserve valuable downtown land for other uses. The measure requires 5 votes, a supermajority, to pass, as opposed to 4, because the Planning and Zoning Commission previously recommended denial in a 5-2 vote. Commissioners David Hartley and Sloan Alberhassi were the lone members present supporting the request at the time. Councilmember Kelly Dunn has been the lone dissenter on the first 2 readings at previous council meetings. Several members of the church have attended the meetings to voice their support, but no one has registered their opposition to the change publicly. The council's evening begins at 6:15 p.m. in committee to hear presentations on the Cedar Falls Community Foundation and the dam along the Cedar River. In other business at 7 p.m., the council will consider the following: selling 8,000 square feet of additional city industrial park land for $20,000 to Katz Properties, LLC, owned by Todd Miller, behind the company's existing building at 6317 Development Drive. Access to the rear is limiting due to a relatively narrow drive and not enough room for truck maneuvering for deliveries. The Best Services Generator Dealer and Ted Electric Electrician Service businesses are tenants there. And an ordinance on the third and final reading to convert the Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Committee into a formal commission to more officially define its role and rules within city government. And the council will consider several resolutions submitting grant applications and, in one case, accepting an awarded grant, including two with hopes of landing funds to assist in paying for the estimated $21.2 million Cedar Falls Community School's future swimming facility next to its new high school on West 27th Street. One is $700,000 for an Enhanced Iowa Community Attraction and Tourism Grant, and the other is $900,000 from the Blackhawk County Gaming Association. The city has earmarked $8 million from its own coffers toward the school district's project. And lastly, the council will consider an agreement with Waterloo to jointly contract with Mosaic Community Planning to help in the development of its five-year plan and annual action plan necessary to land federal funds from the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development. Waterloo's contribution would be $40,582, and Cedar Falls would pay $19,098. And now, listeners, we'd just like to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, September 18th. You're listening on IRIS, I-R-I-S, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's opinion section. Our first editorial today comes from the Sunday Des Moines Register. Attorney General Byrd won't pay for emergency contraception after rape. It's unconscionable. This was written by Mark Stringer, who is the executive director of the ACLU of Iowa. We as a society can all agree that we should support sexual assault survivors as they recover from a devastating attack. Why wouldn't covering the cost of emergency contraception be a part of that? Iowa has a crime victim compensation program, which helps victims with certain out-of-pocket expenses related to injuries from a violent crime. For sexual assault survivors, in the past, that has included testing for sexually transmitted diseases, emergency contraception, and in some rare cases, abortion. The program is entirely funded by fines and penalties paid by those convicted of crimes, not by tax dollars. But Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd has decided that she will stop covering the cost of an abortion for those sexual assault survivors who request it. She also is going to stop covering emergency contraception. That's right, she won't cover costs for preventing pregnancy for a rape victim. The new attorney general has made her position on abortion clear. She wants to ban it. But it's even more cruel and bewildering that Byrd is also withholding reimbursement for emergency contraception. Also called the morning after pill, Plan B, or other brand names, this medication simply prevents the victim from ovulating in the days after the assault so that any viable sperm cannot fertilize an egg. It prevents pregnancy. It does not stop a pregnancy that has already started. Plan B is widely accepted even by those who do not support a woman's choice to have an abortion. Why deny sexual assault victims contraception that can prevent pregnancy? We don't know, and Byrd has declined to explain herself or her position, which is doubly distressing. When a public servant stops an important service, such as this one, they owe the public an explanation. Because of Byrd's decision, local governments and advocacy organizations are scrambling to help undo the Attorney General's damage. In fact, just recently, the Polk County and Johnson County Boards of Supervisors voted to begin covering these health services for sexual assault survivors at a minimal cost. That's the way it should be. When someone is rebuilding their life after a traumatic assault, our leaders should be doing their best to make sure they receive compassionate and complete care. When a woman has been sexually assaulted, figuring out how to afford medical care should be the last thing on her mind. Bird's actions are simply victimizing the very people she's duty-bound to serve, survivors of a violent crime. Next, we have a couple of op-eds from the Storm Lake Times Pilot. The first one is titled, Popular or Just Lucky? This was written by the editor, Art Cullen. Governor Kim Reynolds, speaking at the Family Leadership Summit in Des Moines on July 14, 2023. National news organizations continue to refer to Governor Kim Reynolds as tremendously popular in Iowa as they drop in to cover the Republican caucuses. That ain't necessarily so. No question, Reynolds trounced Democratic challenger Deidre Dejear in 2022 and easily defeated Fred Hubble 4 years earlier. She gained office by ascending when former Governor Terry Branstad was appointed ambassador to China. Dejear was a weak candidate without money. Hubble was not an especially strong candidate with lots of money. Swing voters in Ottumwa or Clinton were not necessarily looking for a corporate billionaire, even if he were a thoroughly decent guy. An Emerson College poll this week reported that its survey of Iowa voters showed Reynolds with 43% approval and 41% disapproval ratings. We sense that's in the ballpark, sort of a toss-up on what people think about Reynolds, with a lot of folks still up in the air. They're waiting to see how this whopper of a legislative agenda bears out. A ban on abortion, bans on books, vouchers for private schools, and, perhaps, eliminating the state income tax. The same poll showed that the economy is the biggest issue for Iowans, and abortion is pretty far down on the list of concerns. It explains why they liked the $2 billion in tax cuts, but aren't crazy about diverting tax dollars to public schools. Former President Donald Trump pretty much disavowed Reynolds for being too chummy with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and other Republican presidential hopefuls. Meanwhile, Trump's standing with Iowa Republicans remained solid. Governor Kristi Noem of South Dakota was happy to endorse Trump last week while Reynolds accompanied DeSantis to the football game in Ames. Reynolds presumably will stand for re-election in 2026, by which time the effects of the Republican agenda will have set in. The tax cuts, combined with the vouchers, could create a fiscal stink bomb. Ramping up sales tax for the benefit of the top income earners might not be a good political play. Reynolds is highly visible and certainly has left her mark on the statehouse in substance and shrill tone. She has no opposition. That does not equate to popularity. The jury is out until 2026 on that question. Things can happen. A Harold Hughes could come out of the weeds. We sense skepticism while knowing that Iowans are loath to upset a sitting governor. Now we have a piece written by Randy Evans, Pentagon Lesson on Waste, Sales into Iowa. Annapolis, Maryland. The literal combat ship USS Sioux City transits the Severn River before it arrives at the U.S. Naval Academy. Sioux City, slated for commissioning November 17th, will be the 13th literal combat ship to enter the fleet and the 6th of the Freedom variant. It is the first ship named for Sioux City, the 4th largest city in Iowa. Iowa is about as far removed from an ocean as you can get, but this state figures in recent news reports about the U.S. Navy, and not in a puff-up-our-chest-with-pride kind of way. One of the reports was a New York Times examination of the Navy's largest shipbuilding budget in history, $32 billion this year alone, and the tug-of-war that pot of money has created inside the seagoing service. On one side of the budgetary ropes are those who favor building traditional warships, the submarines, destroyers, and frigates that make up most of the Navy's hardware. On the rope's other end are those who want the Navy to invest more of its construction budget in a new breed of surface vessels, submersibles, and drones that are unmanned and less expensive to build. There is an urgency to this debate because China's naval forces surpassed the U.S. Navy's vessel numbers several years ago. So what does this have to do with Iowa? While the Times was writing about the Navy's construction budget debate, there was a ceremony on August 14th at the Mayport Naval Station in Jacksonville, Florida. The occasion for the pomp and circumstance was the official decommissioning of the USS Sioux City. In rural lingo, the Sioux City has been put out to pasture. It will be parked and mothballed, its crew of 75 sailors given new assignments. What makes the decommissioning so remarkable are a couple of facts that should anger frugal people from Iowa and beyond. It cost $360 million, one-third of $1 billion, to build the Sioux City. The ship set sail in 2018. Now it has been retired after 4 years and 9 months of service, far short of its intended service life of 25 to 30 years. Therein lies the problem. The Pentagon and the Congress both seem averse to saying no to anything associated with more military spending. The Defense Department asked Congress this year for $840 billion, almost half of the federal government's discretionary spending. Once a new series of ships or airplanes or other weapon systems gets approved, lobbyists for military contractors and home state members of Congress, where those factories or military installations are located, swing into action to keep the money flowing. Those who protest often are labeled unpatriotic or against U.S. security interests. That the Pentagon frittered away $360 million on the USS Sioux City, an equal or larger sums on three sister ships that have been mothballed too, is especially aggravating at a time when some in Congress are questioning whether our nation can justify long-standing promises it made on Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid health benefits, and food assistance for low-income people. The Sioux City is a literal combat ship that was intended to be part of a fleet of 52 small, fast ships that could maneuver on the open seas or in shallow waters closer to shore than other Navy vessels. Those literal combat ships were intended to hunt submarines, locate mines, and intercept suspicious boats, including smugglers and drug runners. But the LCS design has been beset by problems from its earliest days. It's called a gas hog because its fuel costs are comparable to larger ships. Sailors complained they spent more time fixing the ships than sailing them. Indeed, Navy insiders have taken to saying LCS stands for Little Crappy Ship. A spokeswoman for the Sioux City's old squadron at Mayport Naval Station recently gave the Sioux City Journal with its clear-as-mud explanation for why the Navy is retiring the ship. Quote, "To maintain our strategic advantage, particularly under fiscal constraints, it is important for the Navy to carefully review our force structure regularly and divest of legacy capabilities that no longer bring sufficient lethality to maximize our effectiveness in deterring and defeating potential adversaries," unquote. Americans like to parcel out blame for a government blunder by pointing fingers at one political party or the other. As often is the case with Pentagon spending, however, Republicans and Democrats in Congress, and in the White House too, equally embraced the literal combat ship design. Lyle Goldstein, a former U.S. Naval War College professor who studies military costs, told reporters, quote, "There's a lot of money flowing through this vast ecosystem, and somehow the only thing all these people can agree on is more, 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 unquote. Now from the New York Times, an opinion piece written by David Brooks. Mitt Romney has given us a gift. Sometimes you do things that make you feel ashamed. It was the first day of the Republican convention in 2012, and I had nothing to write about. So I wrote a humor column mocking the Romney family for being perfect in every way. It was a hit with readers, but the afternoon it was published, I crossed paths with two of Romney's sons, and they looked at me with hurt in their eyes, which pierced me. I'd ridiculed people for the sin of being admirable. A few years earlier, before he was a senator, Romney asked me to come to Utah to give a talk to a group he was convening. It's a pain to write a speech and get on a plane, but I did it in penance for my sins. Of course, all of the Romneys were lovely to me, as is their nature. And I learned a lesson. The partisans may applaud if you ridicule those you admire, of any political stripe, but stay faithful to them. We all struggle to be the best version of ourselves we can be, and Romney's struggle is now taking him into retirement and out of the Senate. On the way, he gave us a gift in the form of a series of conversations with the Atlantic's McVeigh Coppins, who has written a book on him, excerpted in the magazine. Romney puts on the record what so many of us have been hearing for years off the record, that the Republican Party has become a party of fakers, that its congressional leaders laugh at Donald Trump contemptuously behind his back while swooning over him before the cameras. Mitch McConnell is the tragic figure in Romney's tale. He comes across as, and I believe actually is, a decent man who is trying to mitigate the worst of Trump's effect on his party. But we see the daily corrosions that McConnell must endure to keep up this front, turning a blind eye to Trump's crimes, turning a blind eye to the threats that were coming in the lead-up to January 6th. At one point, McConnell resorts to the rationalization we've heard 1,000 times, that if Trump loses and the Democrats win, they will pass a hard-left agenda that will ruin America forever. McConnell has to exaggerate how radical Joe Biden is and what the electorate will support in order to justify supporting his own party's lamentable leader. McConnell's core problem is that you can't negotiate with narcissism. Every time you make a concession to Trump's selfishness, it voraciously seeks to devour another pound of your flesh. Paul Ryan also makes a sad appearance in this story. Romney tells Coppins that Ryan called him during the first impeachment trial, seemingly lobbying Romney to acquit. Preserve your viability with Republicans, Ryan advises. Preserve your ability to do good. It's advice that once seemed plausible and that guided many upright people to enter the Trump administration as voices of sanity. The first problem with it is that the cult of Trumpism demands absolute fealty. The moment of honest dissent, and you are cast from the ranks. The second problem is that loyalty to Trump is ultimately enforced by the threat of violence. As the Coppins piece makes clear, there were Republicans who chose not to vote yes on impeachment or conviction because the outcome either way was inevitable and because they didn't want potential assassins coming after them or their families. We have gone beyond the bounds of normal democratic governance. The third problem is that if you ally yourself with a con artist, you have become part of the con yourself. You have to become Ted Cruz, who went to Princeton and Harvard Law and is married to an employee of Goldman Sachs, ludicrously popping a brewski live on TV, an elite nerd's attempt to appear populist. Over the Trump years, we've learned how easy it is to anesthetize one's moral circuits. John McCain kept his moral compass, and so did Romney, but they are the exceptions. Many others joined the general fakery. You start by lying about yourself, and pretty soon you're lying to yourself. The pivotal moment for Romney seems to have come on January 6th. Not what the insurrectionists did to get into the Capitol, but what the Republican legislators did in the chambers after the rioters had been cleared out, continuing their efforts to negate the election. This is where 5 years of negotiating with narcissism had brought the party. Romney's retirement, which goes into effect in 2025, will mark the end of an era, the end of the Republican Party that once featured people like Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, and more recently, George Romney, Mitt's father, and George Herbert Walker Bush. Realistically, Romney will have little role in trying to produce a better GOP future. What replaces Trumpism will be different from what came before. I admire him for deciding to step down at the senatorially young age of 76. As we've all come to see, the hunger for continued relevance is the corroding lust that devours the very old. Romney stands for the valuable idea that there are things more important in life than politics and winning elections. The GOP needed to change and become more in touch with the working class, but not in the vicious way Trump has championed. As long as Trump is leading it, the Republican Party cannot be reformed. It can only be deprived of power. This piece was written by David Brooks, an opinion columnist for the New York Times. Now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Monday, September 18th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can listen to a recording of this reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around Iowa that we read. Just go to our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And you may wish to stay tuned to hear the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, which will follow shortly. We want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.